Parenting doesn't come with a manual, and when your child learns differently, there's no one-size-fits-all. Here, we think out the box. We celebrate every unique mind, every different path, and every win, big or small. Welcome to Out the Box, where kids and parents grow together.
Good morning, and welcome to Out the Box on High FM 101.9. For minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. I'm Simone Herring, mom, teacher, literacy and dyslexia therapist. Today's conversation is highly relevant for every family. It's one of those conversations that we simply cannot ignore. And that's why we are addressing it head on, without tiptoeing around it, but doing it with the right support, guidance, and understanding. Because so many of us are carrying emotional stress, fear, uncertainty, and trauma. And very often we are carrying all of this without the tools to navigate it safely. So ask yourselves, we teach children physical first aid. We teach evacuation drills. We teach safety procedures. But what happens when your child experiences trauma? Trauma can quietly enter everyday spaces and experiences. Children are exposed to frightening information, intimidation, fear, uncertainty, and loss. And they themselves are often ill-equipped to know how to respond. So today we're talking about psychological first aid, a powerful new initiative being launched by Hatzola in memory of the late Govey Waxman. Joining us this morning is Sherry Hansen from the Hatzola Medical Rescue South Africa. Sherry is the driving force behind Hatzola's new incredible initiative, which we will be talking about. Sherry holds a PhD in social work and has over 20 years of experience in the welfare and mental health sector. As the mental health coordinator of Hatzola, Sherry has developed and leads three flagship mental health and crisis support initiatives at Hatzola, namely the Mom's Postnatal Wellness Program, Hatzola Connect for Teens, and the Emotional Support Line for Adults. She also heads Hatzola's Crisis Response Unit. Sherry runs a private social work practice in her spare time and co-chairs and consults on many other advisory teams. She's passionate about and committed to community volunteer work. And this morning she joins us to unpack what psychological first aid is and how we can help children and teenagers remain emotionally regulated, supported, and functional after trauma. Sherry, welcome to Out the Box.
Thank you, Simone.
Let's begin with this new initiative Hatzola is launching called the Community Leadership and Resilience Program. Give us a broad overview of the Community Leadership and Resilience Program you are going to launch, because later on we're going to be taking a deeper dive into what it is. So start with what inspired the decision to start a program like this.
So what really inspired us was that teenagers, what we're seeing consistently from Hatzola Connect and from the calls that we get called out to, is that when teens experience a trauma or they're exposed to something traumatic, they are really supported by a professional as their first responder who is supporting them and who's standing there as another teen. That's usually the person that they first tell or disclose something to. And we actually haven't equipped those kids with those kind of skills. And we've changed a lot of the model of our working in terms of our psychological services to that is modeled on the psychological first aid, because we've seen how powerful it is in terms of empowering people with a sense of resilience, with a sense of I can, with a sense of how to get through a trauma. And we've used that to adapt it to teenagers that will be hopefully staying in our wonderful community and developing our community. And we're really wanting to nurture the leadership skills that kids have. And it's not just the kids that are always pinpointed for these kind of programs. We're really looking at who has got these leadership skills that we can really nurture and develop and give them the opportunity to use.
So why does a peer go to another peer for that support? Why don't they go to, you know, we often say that our teenagers, their friends have far much more power than parents. And often they would go to another friend. Why does that happen?
Well, by virtue of the fact that they're teenagers, they already think that adults are not going to understand. So, you know, and the time that they're spending, their developmental task is to be part of their team network. So they will definitely be exposed to the and feel more comfortable to share with friends, even if the friends are not equipped to manage what they're sharing. They are much more likely to share with a friend than a parent or a teacher. And they also often are afraid of the consequences of sharing things. Will they get into trouble? Will they be seen as deviant by an adult? So it is easier for them actually sometimes to talk to a friend.
So as I understand it, the program is designed to equip teenagers with the practical tools and skills that will help them understand and build resilience, emotional regulation, leadership, and peer support. And I honestly believe this conversation matters for every person today, because every generation has its own way of dealing with trauma. And because we all need resilience, connection, and emotional safety, we need to navigate how we do it in this generation of children and what they are exposed to. The program is being launched in the memory of the late Govey Waxman. Why was that meaningful?
So Govey, for those of you who didn't know him, was an extraordinary child with the most beautiful open face smile. And I mention that because I think that's one of the things that allowed other people to feel so easily connected to him. He was a natural leader, and not by a standout typical leadership qualities. He led by actually doing and caring. And that's what we're hoping to perpetuate and to allow children to emulate in this program.
You know, I think may all of this be an aliyah for his beautiful neshama. Sherry, when we first prepared for today's conversation, you told me the name of the program, Community Leadership and Resilience Program. And as I said, you know, this is so needed in our community because it begs the questions, what is the first emotional response after trauma? How do we define it? And when you think of people going into hospitals with physical injuries, they get triage. Is there such a thing as triage for trauma? So in a nutshell, what is psychological first aid in terms of that very initial connection with someone?
Okay, so you've asked me a few questions, which I'll answer one at a time. But the psychological first aid is basically the emotional equivalent of putting a plaster on a wound. It's not surgery, and it's definitely not therapy. It's about the immediate practical human response that's going to help a person feel safe and calm and connected in the immediate aftermath of something that is overwhelming. We've seen very clearly from the research that in the first hours after a trauma, what people need most is not actually to process what happened, it's to be regulated, to be calmed, to feel safe, not to feel alone. And this is what psychological first aid actually provides. It's a very powerful tool in actually getting people, preventing people from developing post-traumatic stress later on down the line. And this is what's amazing about this. Showing up, being calm, being present are all things that adolescents can do. So this is an absolute gem in terms of teaching a skill set to a group of adolescents. You also asked me, can trauma be triaged? Trauma is, there is not one, firstly, it's not linear, and not everyone experiences trauma in the same way. So a whole bunch of people experiencing a singular event will experience it in a different way.
Right.
And that obviously is dependent on what people have experienced in their history, what kind of support systems they already have, what kind of temperament they are likely to have. And the thing about equipping people with first aid, psychological first aid skills, is that it changes the possibility of how they might react in a trauma. So none of us really know how we're going to react in a trauma until we are faced with one. But if you are given the skills of psychological first aid, you are likely to change the way that you will respond in a trauma.
So what I'm trying to understand is that when you speak about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, does that develop many, many years later? And what this psychological first aid might stop from happening? How does that work? Because you often see, for instance, soldiers developing PTSD much later.
Right. So this model has been, as I said, was developed by this Moshe Fachi, who is a doctor of psychology in Israel, and it is endorsed by the Israeli military. So they use this in Israeli schools, in the army, to prevent the post-traumatic stress. And the way in which this happens is that you have a brief period of time after someone experiences a trauma before the brain actually, at the time that you experience it, you get a big rush of cortisol, which is the stress hormone, and your amygdala, which is a part of the brain that is looking after our safety, fires off messages that you are not safe. And it's not, if someone doesn't understand that particular event has ended, and we don't often understand that when we're in a trauma because we've had a flood of information, a flood of sensory experiences, and we can't process things in that way, then we might get those looping thoughts later on, because your brain almost solidifies into a PDF format that you are constantly in a state of danger. And what we see in kids with this is that if they've had a traumatic event that they aren't processing, it might show up in not being able to concentrate in class because they're continually worrying about what's going to happen next, or not being able to socialize in an appropriate way because they are on the alert for danger all the time.
So is it something that helps stabilize the nervous system first? That person has just experienced a traumatic event, and you trying to stabilize the nervous system.
So that's exactly what you're doing. You're re-regulating someone's nervous system so that they can actually stabilize before they start to process things.
And one of the most striking points you made in our conversation was that you don't have to experience a traumatic event firsthand to be emotionally affected by it. Can you explain the different ways or different degrees trauma can be experienced? Like, you know, why indirect exposure can also have a very real emotional impact on adolescents? I imagine, as you said before, that responses to trauma are not a one-size-fits-all. And it depends also where you are in the line of actually experiencing it. Have a think.
Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
I'm Simone, and you're listening to Out the Box on 101.9 High FM, for minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. Today we're unpacking psychological first aid with Sherry Hansen from Hatzolah Medical Rescue South Africa. We are talking about how we can help children and teenagers remain emotionally regulated and functional after a traumatic experience. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Sherry, we were speaking about whether you need to directly experience a traumatic event, or if you can still be traumatized when you see somebody experience it or hear about somebody experiencing it.
So, Simon, you absolutely don't have to experience the trauma yourself. And this is something that we don't really talk about enough. We saw after October the 7th, when children who didn't even have family members in Israel, who had no connection directly, maybe even hadn't been to Israel yet, we saw on our Hatzolah Connect line, where we usually get between 50 and 70 calls a month, we saw 167 calls that month. Wow. So there was a lot of dysregulation because people, you can witness, hear, scroll. You know, we as parents often like to think we're in control of the information that our children are exposed to, and we aren't. And every time someone opened Instagram, they were traumatized by what they saw. So you definitely don't have to have to experience it directly, because children couldn't, their nervous system couldn't distinguish between, is this happening to me or is it happening to my people? So that is what we would call indirect trauma. And it's completely valid. And it needs to be acknowledged, because sometimes when people are supporting their friends, and this is also what we're needing to teach adolescents, that they don't have to take on someone else's trauma in order to be supportive for them, to them.
So in an instance like the terrible photos that were disseminated from October the 7th on social media, just children, teenagers seeing that, they can never unsee it. Mm-hmm. And their trauma must be affected by the actual visual. You know, when we were growing up, we didn't see photographs of such things. We may have heard it on the grapevine, but I think social media has opened up a can of worms that is really not good for our children. Do you agree?
I completely agree, but I think that that's why it's so important for parents to be making, and teachers to be making, spaces for children to name, talk about, understand the things that they are seeing, because you can't regulate yourself if you don't know what to name it.
I mean, it's such an important message that you give for us as parents. We need to really consider that our teenagers process experiences differently, because often our instinct is, talk to me now, tell me everything, because that's going to, in a way, comfort the parent, knowing that their child has opened up for them. Sherry, we hear people speak about the fight, flight, freeze responses during trauma, but there's also another response that I've recently learned about. It's where people immediately jump into action. Is there a name for that type of trauma response? And give us an example of how it would present.
Okay, so let me just unpack a little bit the fight and flight response. So when we perceive a threat, which is either real or perceived, our nervous system will activate automatically. So the fight will be an aggressive or an angry response, and the flight is an avoidance or withdrawal. And then the freeze is when we completely become like deer in the headlights and we cannot move or speak. And these are all survival responses. They're not character flaws or bad behaviors. They're just the way that our system responds to a trauma. And the fourth response that you are talking about, which is actually talked about less, is the most relevant to the program we actually are developing, and that's the adaptive coping response, where you are doing something. So some people, and particularly people with leadership qualities, will respond to a crisis by doing, by organizing, by helping, by problem solving, and it's an instinct to move towards the problem rather than moving away from it. And this is incredibly valuable, and that's what we're wanting to equip the kids with. What do you actually do in a crisis situation?
So can you give us an example of somebody stepping into a crisis situation and doing?
Well, I'll give you two fabulous examples. During the tsunami, which probably our generation will remember and not younger, but there was an incredible young man who was there on holiday, Daniel Traceman, who hadn't had any formal leadership. He was just training. He was just on holiday. And he wrote on the back of his T-shirt, "If you are South African, follow me." And that is how he organized people into groups so that they could be located by family members in South Africa. And it's those simple tasks of doing that leave people feeling like they have a sense of agency over how things unfolded, because that's often what's taken away from us in a trauma, that we have no sense of agency and we feel like something is being done to us.
Right.
When we have a sense of control and we feel like we're adding to a situation in a positive way, then we feel like I have control over how I'm responding to what's being done to me, which is a different mentality and different look on it.
And I think it also, I would imagine that it would give the people who are going to follow him a sense of connection, a sense of, you know, we're going to follow him, he's going to take us somewhere, and we are going to feel connected, we'll be together with, you know, our own. And
exactly.
Yeah.
It's a calm, regulating, you're not alone, I'm committed to you until we get a solution. That is the model of the 60s.
And your second example?
So the second example happened at the October the 7th Memorial commemorative space that Great Park had, where all the different community organizations and schools brought together some way of commemorating what had happened on October the 7th. I think it was the first anniversary after that dreadful event. And everyone was already emotionally heightened, vulnerable, feeling a sense of real rawness in response to what had happened. And then there were demonstrators that arrived pulling down pictures of hostages and babies and shouting dreadful slogans. And they really were instilling a sense of fear and intimidation. And a young Habonim leader stood up on the sort of mountain where everyone was, and he said, "Come, we're going to go in a circle and sing." And it all of a sudden brought about a sense of achdut and togetherness and community, mm-hmm. and we're not alone, and we have a task, and we know what to do, and it's a cognitive task, mm-hmm. not an emotional one. And the whole temperature of hysteria was brought completely down. Mm.
Incredible. That. But does that person who does, are they affected by the trauma?
So they're affected by the trauma, but in a different way, because, again, they're not receiving their response to the trauma from an external locus of control. They feel like they have agency over how they have experienced the trauma, and that changes their outcome.
And is that what the type of skill set that you are going to give the kids that are going to be on your program?
Yes, that's exactly the skill set that we are hoping to give over to the young leaders that we are going to choose.
We also spoke about something that really stood out for me. You said that after a traumatic experience, the brain and the nervous system may first need time to settle before a person can properly process what happened. Can you explain why immediate emotional processing is not always helpful, and how psychological first aid helps to reduce I don't want to call it overreaction, is the wrong word.
It's an overstimulation.
Correct.
And it's a disabling sense of what has happened to one, so that you start to feel disabled and paralyzed in the face of what's happened.
And that takes place in that immediate emotional processing, as soon as something's happened.
So basically, you know, what we've seen from our research now in trauma, that historically we would rush to give a trauma debriefing straight after an event. And often people will phone after trauma and say, you know, we just got hijacked, or we just had this event and we need trauma debriefing immediately. Mm. And actually it's very counterintuitive, is what the research is showing us, because when you experience a trauma, you've got this absolute flood of information, this heightened sensory response. You've got no defenses up. You're sharing in a way that doesn't protect yourself. Your brain works very cleverly in what it shares. And when you've been traumatized, the floodgates are open. So you really can share anything and actually re-traumatize yourself in the process.
And you're overriding the systems in your brain.
You're overriding
those
systems.
Neural.
Yeah, and you overexposing yourself to the traumatic events before you've had a chance to regulate.
I understand. And sometimes you expose yourself in a way that you would never normally,
right.
normally do. Let's go back a step, or not really back a step, but into a segment where we're going to address trauma, teens, you know, and the brain. What happens neurologically, and you were speaking about the brain now, but what happens neurologically in the brain during trauma? And you also mentioned something about neural pathways being rewired in a traumatic situation or going through a traumatic experience.
So if I speak about adolescents specifically, it's already a neurologically heightened time for them. And the emotional brain is working overtime while their regulatory systems are still catching up. So their frontal lobe actually hasn't, their prefrontal cortex hasn't developed properly and matured properly until really about 25. And that's where all your executive decision making happens. And it's really, you add trauma to that mix of immaturity and lack of development, and you have reactions that can really, really start to look extreme.
Yeah.
So, you know, like complete withdrawal or risk-taking behavior, explosive anger or emotional numbness. And none of these are actually pathological. They're developmentally predictable, actually, to overwhelming experiences. And this is why teen support is so helpful, actually, in this age group, the right teen support.
You know, I agree so much, because often something won't happen directly to the person. And suddenly we see them as being dramatic, or, you know, don't overreact. This is really not, it's not your trauma. So you're responding, you know, in a way that is inappropriate. How do we understand that, and how do we teach our teenagers the skills to know not to overreact, not to necessarily make something directly yours, and not to want to step into a space where you are not close to the person, you know the person, and you kind of want to step into that space and help them, but for that person, you're not their direct, you know, point of call.
So I think with adolescents, and I don't think it's just adolescents, I think with adults too, we try and process and understand something that is a trauma, which is completely we cannot understand it. It doesn't fall within the realm of what we are expected to understand. That is what trauma is about. It's something that is not what is expected. And one of the ways that we do that is to either try and distance ourselves as far as possible from the possibility of it happening to us, or to get close enough to almost understand exactly what happened so that we can say, okay, now I've got it. I know exactly what happens. I know not to drive it, which area, at what times. I'll never get hijacked. It's a way of trying to control the narrative, which isn't helpful, A, because it's not real,
yes,
and B, because for the person who you're trying to overstep into that space for, it can be enormously intrusive and unhelpful. So I think with adolescents who are also a little bit hot-wired to drama, we're wanting to teach them what real support actually looks like and how to ask and find out from people what they really need. And one of the things that we want to teach adolescents is how to notice when kids do need something.
Yes.
That a lot of the time someone's walking next to them all the time or sitting next to them in class, and they've got no idea the implosion that's happening for that child inside. So how do you ask that question, are you okay? Do you need something? What is it that you need, without stepping in and overriding? You know, in our particular amazing Jewish community, and I always say to people, there is no better place to raise children, and there's no better place to come back to than Johannesburg. We have a very amazing particular community, but sometimes the things that we do in order to help inadvertently become unhelpful, and we can overstep lines and we can break boundaries, and that's part of what we teach in children. What are the healthy boundaries in relationships, and how do we maintain those?
And I think that even speaks to adults. You know, we often don't know how to respond. We don't know what questions we are allowed to ask, and sometimes, you know, and it's definitely not with malice, but sometimes we overstep and we ask questions that are intrusive. Like, for instance, you know, somebody had a car accident, and you ask the other person, well, what exactly happened? Like you said, where were you driving? Was the person driving drunk? Was the person, you know, driving too fast? Because, as you said, that's a way of you trying to take control and then say to yourself, well, this couldn't happen to me because now I'm going to follow these steps. I'm not going to do what happened. We also need to know, and I think that it's really essential, that when a person is in a state of heightened stress, you know, there could be two people, one teenager and another teenager, and they may experience the same event but completely different. Even siblings who may experience an event extremely differently, and one may become functional and one may be, you know, become dysfunctional. what causes that? What within a person makes one?
Well, again, it's going to be around what experience you've had previously, what kind of support systems you have around you organically already before this has happened. And just because siblings grow up in the same household definitely doesn't mean that they are exactly the same. So some people react differently to things than others, and sometimes your position in the family will change things because you're given more opportunities at leadership and gaining a sense of control as the older sibling than maybe the younger sibling has.
Right.
So there are a whole lot of different varying factors that will change the outcome of that. But I really would like to say at this juncture that there are things that, as parents, that we can do differently. And we are, unfortunately, a generation of parents who don't want our children to experience any trauma at all. And as a parent, I completely understand that and don't want my children to experience trauma either. But it then means that we mitigate against any circumstance that might help them build a little bit of grit or resilience. And that when we are mowing things down in front of them so that the path is completely smooth, we don't give them a chance to actually develop that sense of I can. And we wire their nervous system to understand that you can't without me. And that's what we're wanting to change.
For our listeners, hold on to that thought.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
You're listening to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9. Today's conversation is all about psychological first aid, practical emotional support tools for children, teenagers, and adults after trauma. And joining me is Sherry Hansen, the Mental Health Coordinator at Hatsula Rescue South Africa. We'd really value your thoughts and experiences this morning, so WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Sherry, we're moving into resilience and what resilience means. It's a word that is, I wouldn't say overly used, but that is used kind of loosely as to what it really means. So I want you to unpack, what does resilience truly mean? And how do we learn, this is a later question, but how do we learn to recover, regulate, and reconnect after our difficult experiences? Do we have to go through trauma in order to become resilient?
Okay, so as you said, Simon, resilience is one of those words that gets used so often that it actually starts to lose its meaning. And people will say things like, our community is so resilient, and what they often mean is our community just keeps going, which is true and admirable, but I don't want to, you know, I would like to caution against not equating resilience with the absence of pain or having to be tough. True resilience is actually the capacity to be impacted by difficulty and then regulate and recover afterwards. And the word, you know, resilience is about springing back. But it's not about snapping back as if nothing happened. It's about moving through something that's hard and coming out of it functional on the other side with your sense of self intact. And that often requires support. And it's such an, you know, bouncing back and emotional suppression is something to think about in terms of distinguishing between the two, because when we tell our children to be strong or to just move on or don't let that affect you, we might be thinking that we are encouraging resilience in them, but what we actually can inadvertently be teaching our children is to suppress their feelings. And, you know, you cannot expect true resilience to come out without emotional awareness. Children have to be able to feel, name, and process an emotion. As it's absolutely foundational to be able to regulate your emotions. You can't build resilience on suppression.
And the point that really strikes me there is that, and I said it in the beginning when we first started speaking, is that processing trauma in one generation is very different to processing trauma in another generation. And parents being, you know, even if we speak about Holocaust survivors, how many of them didn't speak about the trauma and suppressed it completely? Mm-hmm. Does that teach the next generation to react to trauma in the same way? So we almost have to re-educate and realign and teach what a healthy response to trauma would be.
Yes, absolutely. And we see in intergenerational studies of Holocaust survivors how that traumatic memory is passed on and how the responses are passed on. So we do need a different way of managing it. And actually, resilience is a skill. It's not something that you're born with or you're not born with. And that's what's so amazing about being able to inculcate that into a program and a culture and a school environment, is that you can actually teach resilience to children.
So it's not a natural trait?
Not necessarily. I think some children are more prone to be more resilient, but it means that the fact that it is a teachable skill means that it is available to everybody.
Okay. And as I said, before, do we have to experience hardship in order to become resilient?
So I definitely think that you do not have to experience hardship in order to become resilient. Trauma that is unsupported doesn't build resilience. So if you go through a hardship or a trauma and you're not supported, you actually can become avoidant, hypervigilant, you have a heightened sense of helplessness. The variable isn't about the hardship or the trauma itself, it's about the quality of support around the person who's experienced it.
Right. And we as adults, try to support our children after trauma without unintentionally increasing the fear or making the person feel helpless, almost taking away, when you speak about resilience and moving through a traumatic experience, we speak about empowering people. And unintentionally, as parents, we try to overhelp and take away that responsibility, kind of take over completely and not let the person deal with almost day-to-day stuff that they need to do.
So the most powerful thing that an adult can do is to be regulated themselves first. It's that real cliche example of putting the oxygen mask on yourself before you help your child. Because children co-regulate with us, and then to support a child's own coping rather than bypassing it, you're asking them, what do they need? What do you need from me? Instead of, I know exactly what you need and I'm going to fix this for you. Give them something to do where possible, help them maintain their routines, and be honest with children. They are exquisitely sensitive to adult pretense. That when we say, this is hard and we're going to get through it, it's far more powerful and regulating than a panicked, everything's fine.
Yes, and get back on the horse.
Right.
I think that's often, get back on the horse and you'll be fine. Another profound idea that keeps emerging in the conversation is the importance of communal support and shared connection after trauma. Why is it so important for teenagers specifically? We talk about that frontal lobe being undeveloped. Why is it so important for teenagers to feel supported, not by only individuals, but by schools, communities, and the people around them during difficult experiences? And in a way, this is what your program is trying to create, is support and connection. So my question is, the importance of communal support and a shared connection after trauma. Do you have to share that trauma, either in a first, second, third, or fourth degree, in order to help a person?
Are you asking me, Simone, do you have to be part of that trauma in order to be able to help someone?
Yes, but not directly involved, but perhaps you are a friend of a friend whose friend has undergone a terrible traumatic experience. Often teenagers want to be involved. It's often a curiosity that isn't healthy for them. Think on that.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
56 years and going strong. The Kollel Bookshop has its annual sale from the 31st of May to 8th June, inclusive prices from 25% to 30% off on virtually all stock. Buy from displayed stock at never-to-be-repeated prices. Place and pay for specials inclusive of delivery. See you from 31st of May to the 8th of June at the Colel Bookshop. Sherry, let's just go back a step where we were talking about how much connection matters and how much teenagers and adolescents need to be supported also by their peers and other individuals. But what is the importance of psychological first aid in schools, communities, and people around them during difficult experiences?
Okay, so the first part of your question, Simon, around what is the importance of having community support? When you experience a trauma, you have a profound sense of being alone. And that disconnected, alone feeling is what sends people into a spiral, and they can't come back, and they can't regulate from that trauma. And we are wanting to help people feel connected in their moment of loneliness. That's part of one of the skills of the psychological first aid. If anyone's ever had the privilege of going on to the King David Encounter experience and seeing, they have one day where they showcase all the different organizations in our community, and it really is a moment where you look back and you think, oh my goodness, we have literally everything in this community, but yet there are times where people still say they feel profoundly alone, even though there are all these services. And what we're wanting to do with this course is teach children how to reach out for help. That's a skill, by the way. People don't naturally do it. And particularly teenagers who feel everything is shameful and everything is looked at with disdain, which is often not inaccurate. We're wanting to teach them how to reach out for that help and where to reach out for that help. And that kind of talks to the second part of your question of how do you help children respond appropriately to traumatic things that they hear, see, or do. And that's the other skill that happens. What's the appropriate way of responding? And how do you know when that boundary is beyond what your pay grade is? How do you know when to access bigger help than what you can give? So that's part of the skill set that we are hoping to impart.
Because, you know, sometimes I think that children, teenagers are exposed to existential questions and things that that perhaps at that age is the right time to speak about these things, but are they being scaffolded? Are they being supported? Are they being helped to process what all these existential kind of ideas and thoughts are? And how do you support how does one support that in a safe environment? So even with trauma, something happens at a school or, you know, at a soccer club, and you need to scaffold the children and you call someone in. What does that look like?
So I think our schools are really good at doing that for the most part. I think they really get that right. And I think our community is very reactive in the face of a trauma, that we put things in place and we do offer opportunities. I think what's important is to think about the fact that not everyone experiences the same thing means that not everyone needs the same intervention. Mm. So we're needing to provide different layers of help and different opportunities to access help and different kinds of help when we start putting that scaffolding up and when we think about what that looks like. Maybe now I can just speak a little bit about what kind of scaffolding we're hoping to put in place for this course.
Yes.
That we are going to be providing this 8-week intensive skill set to leadership development program, and then they are going to go on an incredible immersive weekend where they are going to have a lot of simulation and opportunity to practice the skills that they've been given. But then we're going to be holding them through that whole next year of their schooling, where they're going to have a personal mentor, they're going to meet once a month as a cohort and be exposed to different kinds of leaders in different sectors of the Jewish community. So we really are hoping to put in multiple layers where we can start to change the culture around what support looks like in our community and how we support each other.
You know, I think that's an incredible, incredible initiative that you are putting out there. I always, you know, try to find a quote that will be appropriate for the discussion that we have. And I came across, and never before has this saying, you know, been truer. Superheroes don't always wear capes. And Sherry, before we end, What gives you hope when working with young people?
What gives me hope is that they always show up. I mean, we have a team of incredible Hatsola Connect counselors that show up. They come to training, show up for shifts, give of themselves, give of their holidays. I see it in the camp counselors. They have a sense of selflessness and giving to the other that makes me want to give more to them. So that essentially is what drives my hope.
Sherry, I salute you and all those from Hatsola and all the other dedicated community organizations. We don't say it enough. We are blessed to have you in our lives. You've been listening to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9 with me, Simone Herring. If you missed any part of today's conversation, catch the podcast on the Chai FM website. As many trauma-informed therapists say, safety is not only the absence of danger, but the presence of connection. And I think this is extremely pertinent to the initiative that Sherry and Hatsola are looking to roll out. Until next week, keep thinking differently, keep supporting bravely, and keep making space for the minds and hearts of all our young people. Pause and take a moment to think about what connection means to you as you listen to Bill Withers' Lean on Me.